Okoki is a child that was always magical. The parents were more relaxed. You got a lot of attention from parents. You get read to. And of course, there was always storytelling. You'd set a fire in the wood stove, and they'd have the popcorn basket and melted butter. And some people would be on the pune, and the chairs around the stuff, and you'd be munching away listening to people telling these stories. You know, the walks, the horseback rides, the freedom to move. You know, there was lots to do. And I don't know, there's always been that kind of lovely feel. And people are just much more relaxed. And so the family entertainment was sit around after dinner and tell stories, you know, and keep kids busy that way. And my grandfather was a great storyteller, and he would take us horseback riding. So we'd horseback ride over to Kipukai on that side, or all the horseback riding up here. And to keep his, you know, I was 3, 4, 5, to keep us all quiet, he'd say, "Wait a minute, see that rock?" You know, and we'd stop and he'd tell us the story. You know, I love it.
What's one kokei story?
One kokei story? You know, the Kanaloa Huluhulu. That's the meadow right up here that they sing. And that's always been clear. I think geologically it was a lake at one time, and then it drained out, and it's alkaline enough or salty enough that nothing except grass has ever grown on there, and all the trees they've tried to plant in the center of the meadow have all died. And it used to be the center location for all of the trails around the island. From here, you can go out along the entire Napali. The trail went along the top of all of the valleys, and of course each valley you have at least one ridge that the trail went down. And then from here you hook over towards Kawaikoi, and you can get out to Waialeale. And then you can also get to the top of Wainiha Valley, where they call Kilohana. And from there, there was a trail that went down this narrow razor's edge that just goes swooping down into Kalala and into Wainiha. And that was the original trail that people walked up and down from Kalala. You knew where you were if you got to here, because the road through the Alakai is terrible. And the thing is, the minute the fog comes in, you and I can be this close and can't see each other, and can barely hear each other, and have really no idea where the other one is located. It's really incredible. And the Menehunes, of course, lived in it, and because there are several Menehune names there. The last queen, Mohihi, her name is still in existence up there. And they left the islands finally to go home again from Haena.
Was this the last holdout of the Menehune up here?
Yeah. They pulled themselves away from the, I guess we call them the Hawaiian group, within the first generation. The first known settler to this island, the legend states that he had certain projects that he wanted done, and so he sent back to wherever their homeland was for the Menehune. And they came in with their chief, their high priest. Eventually they ended up with 10 divisions of men and 7 of women, each with their own particular skill within each of these groups.
So they're known as doers.
Yeah, oh, that's what they were. The big engineering projects are theirs. The earliest heiaus are all mentioned as being Menehune. 2 at Wailua. There's one here in Waiava that's still completely visible. If you know where to look, everybody's letting it, they know the grass and the Kiawe grow over it to keep people from taking it apart. So they're the oldest ones, and the engineering is incredible, because like the Menehune Ditch. The Menehune Ditch was designed because the third generation of the earliest known settlers was a young man named Ola, and he wanted to bring in the water so that Waimea, where Waimea Town now is, could be watered enough to have taro growing there. Ola called on the Menehune to come, and they said they would on three conditions. One, nobody disturbed him at all while they worked. Two, he had to lie in the irrigation ditch where the water was to come. And if everything had been done properly, they would pull him out before he drowned. And if it wasn't, they'd let him drown. And three, that every Menehune had to have one piece of something to eat each, some seafood or something like that. And each one was supposed to have one. So Ola and his right-hand man, P.E., agreed to this, and the Menehunes built the ditch by starting at the bottom of the lake, of the river, which was 20 feet down, and cut rock, that then they carved it, so that each of these things are about 8 inches square on the ends, and about 3 feet long. And each one of them is left with a little peg at one corner, and the one below it has a puka that this thing drops into. So each one of these things is really hooked in. And they built this thing up 20 feet up from the river bottom, and then wide enough so that they could put an Hawaii irrigation ditch across the top of it and bring the water in to Waimea. And it's still there. You can see the top 3 feet. They built the road over it and have filled in kind of at the bottom, so there's very little left to see. The quarry is still visible. Ola had collected a fish, so he got a whole bunch of little fish, and the Menehunes lined up to come back up because they lived over on the ridge between Waineha and Lumahai. And they passed out the fish, but unfortunately the fish ran out before the Menehune did, and big consternation, now what do we do? And the Menehunes gave him little time to think it over, and Ola promised that each one of them would have a shrimp, and that he would see that there were enough of that. So of course they not only fished the ocean, they fished every single stream to get the V and all this kind of stuff. And finally got the Menehunes lined up again, and the last man and the last shrimp coincided, and so the Ola was left to live. But this is typical of the Menehune. If they didn't like the project, they wouldn't do it. And if they got interrupted, they wouldn't finish it.
They're legendary people.
They were real people. They're not legendary. They had engineering skills far beyond what the Hawaiians ever ended up with. One heiau over in Wailua has rocks that they estimated about 30 tons that have been moved there. And nobody has the faintest idea how they got them there. These carved rocks, squarish rectangular things, are unique in the islands. They don't occur anywhere else.
Menehune didn't go to any other island?
There are some stories on Oahu, and then it sort of spilled over a little bit into Maui, but not to the big island that I know of.
Where'd they come from?
Nobody knows, because nobody knows where the first settlers came from who sent back to the homeland. That they don't know where they came from. We do know that over on the Western Pacific, near Fiji, there is a complete stone city that's almost like Venice in the sense that there are canals and all this kind of stuff, and it's completely overgrown now with rubbish and stuff. But they think that's as closest to what the Menehunes were actually able to accomplish here that occurs anywhere else in Polynesia. So whether the original settlers in the Menehune came out of Tonga, Samoa, directly from Fiji or one of those islands there, nobody knows. We don't know.
Was it stonework like the Incan stonework?
Something similar. Again, the big mystery of the sweet potato. Because one of the sweet potatoes carries a Menehune name, and I can't remember it at the moment. So whether the Menehunes had been to the east, you know, the west coast of South America or not, we don't know. But they now found archaeologically that the type of coconut that was indigenous to Peru and that area in there that came out this way. The problem comes with the Menihuni because then the legends go on, and they built the Menihuni fish pond, which is in Nahuliwili, which is a dam that is 320 feet long. All of it is, it's a dirt dam, but then paved with stone on the top and both sides, which was left unfinished because the chiefess and his sister broke what he was supposed to do. He were not supposed to watch them and looked at it, and the chief poked a finger through the thatch and peered, and they saw him, and they just dropped all the rocks right where they were and would never finish the project. So it's one of those. But and then the story of their leaving, they decided that the people were intermarrying too much, and that they were not keeping Menihunis to Menihunis. They were marrying into the Hawaiian. And so the queen, Mohihi, decided it was time to go home again. And there is absolutely no legend or thing to indicate that they didn't always know how to go home. And so she gathered all of the Menihuni here.
Where?
They came back to this meadow here because they walked along the Napale Cliff valleys at the top because they wanted to come down at Haena, where they had their fleet of canoes waiting on the beach there, where the county park is today. They sailed off and nobody's ever heard of them since.
When was that?
The problem comes is that the earliest group that they were had a formed a kind of a, call it a kingdom, centered in and around Waimea. And about six centuries after the first of them came, a group came from the Marquesas and settled on the Wailua River and formed their own kingdom, the Puna, and eventually the two sides got into warfare, and the Puna side won. And so all of the legends and the genealogies of the Kona side died out.
Kona side is where?
That's centered in Waimea, the Waimea side. It actually is from, you know, where the Koloa Gap is, the tree line that goes to, from there, and then including Mahalipu and Koloa and all the way to Mana was the thing. And of course, the boundary line is right up here at the top of the valley, you know, on the top of the meadow. So a lot of the stuff is missing, but as they say, it's interesting that the Menihuni, there is nothing to indicate that they didn't know how to go home, because there was another small group called the Mu. This is the MU. They were brought again from their homeland. They were brought by their homeland by Ola's grandson, Kalaulehua, because he wanted to dig a ditch from the Lake Waialeale, which is the headwaters of the Wainiha and of the Lumahai rivers. And he wanted to build a ditch so that it would also become the headwaters of the Wailua River. And when the Mu came, having been tricked into getting onto the canoes, they refused to do it. And so Kalalehua tabooed where they could live. They could only live in the upper reaches of Wainiha Valley and in Alka'i Swamp over to Kawaikoi Stream. And that was anything above that, they would be immediately put to death. So they lived on bananas. They're known as the banana-eating people.
The Mu?
The Mu. There are two types of Mu. This is the silent Mu and the noisy Mu. But the group here was very definitely the silent one. And there is a very long legend concerning them when they tried to find the way home. And it's a very long and complex thing that takes place in the time of Manokalanipo, which is around 1300, 1350, somewhere in there. So you compare this very long, detailed legend of how they finally work out how to get home against the Minnehuni, who simply gathered together and went to Hyena and got under the canoes and left, is, you know, startling. So you have the feeling that they really did know where they were going, wherever it was.
Were they gone by the time the moon got here?
No.
No?
No, but the moon never intermingled with the moon. The moon were always called the wild people. The people would catch glimpses of them. We have people in Hyena and Waini who still claim descent both from the Minnehuni and the moon. So they were real people, but in the sense that, you know, legendary, you can't prove it. People say, oh, you had these little people and the giants and this kind of stuff. Like, yeah, but if you remember that Kamoli'i, who was the last king, died in 1824, one of the requirements to be one of his personal guards was that you had to be 6'5" tall. And so you take somebody whose natural height is under 5 feet, let's say 4'10", and you put against somebody who's 6'5", you have your dwarf, you have your giant, right?
What were the characteristics of Minnehuni?
Very industrious. In that they would take on a project, but there was a group project always. It was never something that was accomplished by one person. It was always a group effort, the big things. They were also extremely cunning, because there are stories of, for instance, one Minnehuni who had his, loved jumping into the water feet first, which was a favorite sport, and he did it, and a shark tried to get him, and he got really ticked off about that. And he didn't rest until he had caught the shark and brought it ashore, you know. In spite of the fact that one of the place names is a scar on the cheek, which he got when the birds attacked his fish, and he didn't want them to do that either. And another Minnehuni further along, who was having an affair with a native woman, and got almost caught, and he was out in the reef at Molawa, and looking around, you know, they didn't know, what are you doing here, you know, what's this about? And he said, well, I'm just drinking from the spring here. And they said, what do you mean, spring? There's no spring out in the middle of the reef. Only it turned out that there was. But he knew it, and nobody else knew it. So the spring is still called by his name. And if you know where it is, you could really spook people by drinking fresh water.
Underwater?
Yeah. And it comes right up to the surface so that you can be made to look as though you were drinking the salt water, but you're drinking from this freshwater spring. So they were very cunning, very mischievous in that sense.
Mischievous?
They loved to tease each other, but never really meanly, you know, they enjoyed pulling jokes on each other. And as I said, they were the division of skills. So each child, we don't quite know how the child was, you know, whether just because it was him, did he follow his father, and it was a her, did she follow her mother? We don't know, but they were well trained. So that you had fishnet makers, you know, that was their particular skill with making all the different kinds of nets and traps, and that's what they did. And another one was made the tapa, and you know, everything from the wauke to the oils and paints that they decorated with. Some of the men were farmers, some were land fishermen, some were sea fishermen. The women were the ones who did most of the river and reef fishing. You know, it was an extremely well organized. Evidently, their calabashes and stuff like that were of noticeably different design. Because we have things here on this island that aren't different from any other island, except Nihoa and Necker. Yeah, they we have stonework and stone implements that were found there too. So, like the Kauai has two different kinds of poi pounders. One is the stirrup pounder, and the other one is the one that has the double prong at the top. Whereas, you know, the standard poi pounder you think of is all the other islands, but that was not used on Kauai. But the stirrup evidently is found nowhere else.
You know, we heard that Menehune were even included in the census.
Yeah, the 1914 census of Wainiha. There are, I believe, 14 people who claim Menehune descent.
Will it be like intermarried mixture with Hawaiian?
Oh, yeah, they were mixed. In fact, one of them was the head fisherman for Wainiha and Haena. He was a little man, a small man. His wife was almost triple his height. When he got drunk and stuff, she'd march in and pick him up under her arm and carry him home. But he was a marvelous fisherman. And that's the thing, you see, because I wish now that I knew then what I know now so that I could have asked, you know, the right kinds of questions. And I look at my grandfather and I look at people like La'a and I think, oh, I wish I'd really talked with them, you know. But at this point, you know, at that time, you enjoy hearing the stories, and it's just part of the stuff, and you don't think that if you don't talk now, people are going to lose. Mm-hmm. You know, and I realize, too, that now with what I have accomplished in my lifetime, in this time, that when I go, if I don't have it down or if I haven't told my kids, it's going to go, too.
It's there's kind of a whole feeling that people were a part of that.
You run always into the problem that most of what we have were put down from about 1835 to, let's say, 1930. And most of these people were, that stuff was handed over into Howley's hands. Certain like Judge Fornander or Emerson spoke beautiful Hawaiian. Emerson's first language was Hawaiian. Just as my great-grandfather was, his first language was Hawaiian. He grew up speaking Hawaiian. He said he always dreamed it, right? When he dreamed, he always dreamed in Hawaiian.
Oh, really?
So it makes it kind of fun.
Your great-grandfather?
Was William Hyde Rice.
Okay.
So I laugh because my children are descended from the first royal governor of Kauai, Kaikioewa, and from the last one, from William Hyde Rice. One on their mother's side and one on my side. So another thing with the Menehune is that in about 1890, a Norwegian, one of the Norwegians who came out of Norway and settled in the Waimea-Kekaha area, was a man by the name of Hofgaard, and he started the first mercantile store down here in Waimea. And there were always little stories of people seeing these little people scurrying around, you know. So this little Menehune stories kind of got around, and he heard all of those, and he equated them with his home brownies, the Scandinavian brownie, which is like the Irish leprechaun. And so he would tell stories about them, but he would bring over the stories that were told about the brownies and not the Menehunes from Kauai, you see. So a lot of the distortion on the idea of Menehune as being, you know, fictional people, and, you know, like the leprechaun, yeah, sure, you know, has all stemmed from him in 1890. And
oh, really?
So, and you see all the stuff in Menehune nowadays, and you look at that, and think, That has nothing to do with the original real people.
They didn't ever seem like a real people when I was growing up, because they always worked at night, and if they couldn't finish in one night, that they wouldn't finish.
Yeah, but of course the one night business is that nobody remembers that the Hawaiians' day, so-called, began at 6 o'clock at night and went through until the following evening, so what we call the evening. That was their day, from 6 o'clock at night to the following 6 o'clock at night. And they called it night, not day. So, of course, if they worked all night and they worked all day, they could gather the material during the dark, and then they could build what they needed to see during the rest of the time. And that's just sort of a thing that came up. But whether this also may have involved a longer period of time, you know, like the term Anahulu, which was a 10-day period, it wasn't just, you know, when the sun went down and they did the work, and when the sun came up, it was all finished. but they went on a little bit longer.
I'm really interested in that, the wall that is still there.
It was measured and drawn before they put the road across it. The modern road goes right across that wall and is based on the wall. It, that wall is still supporting the road and the traffic that goes on it.
Oh, on what road?
You have to go up the road that's by the fire station. The fire station's here, Big Save is there, and you're just going up there until you come around a cliff. And over on the left-hand side going up, you will see just, you know, there's just about one or two, three rocks, you know, these things sticking up out of the road for only about 3 feet. It should be one of the marvels of Hawaiian culture, and you know, it's just like across the river in the quarry they have found some of these rock carved, I don't know really what you call them, building pieces with the little pegs still there. They never used them, so they just left them there.
Have they tried to determine what time period it might have been built?
No, because nobody has ever paid any attention to Kauai. Archaeologically, the whole Waimea Canyon was the largest community of Hawaiians who had no direct access to the sea. And they went up all of those valleys. The name, place names are just incredible up in there. And my son Randy has gone up several of the smaller things and taken days and just gone up. And he says the thing is just incredible with sites and walls and this kind of stuff. And
really?
And so, but until such time as something can really be done properly, you know, we just don't want amateurs running around loose in there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I kept running into in trying to search out place names and stories, you'd run into people then who would look at me and say, well, what do you want to know for, Holly? All you're going to do is use them and sell them for your own profit. My answer to that one is always, I personally don't need to know, but what I do need to know is that you are not letting them go. You know, don't wait for them to come to you. You go find them. And just pass the stuff on, you know. And I went back home, and my number three son says, well, you've never told us any of these stories either. And it's high time you got going. Which is where the book Kauai Tales came from, because those were the ones that came out.